All right, I think it's about time to get started. Third day of a very busy conference, so you've all been attending lots of sessions. We'll try to make it a little bit interesting. Hopefully, you came here because you'd like to hear a little bit about the topic of how we build high availability, high performance servers using SMB3. We just renamed the protocol for the Windows Server 2012 version to SMB3, so if I make a mistake and call it 2.2, you'll understand. It's 3.0 now. I'm Gene Chellis, Director of Program Management for Windows Storage, Server Storage and Availability. And with me is Klaus Jorgensen. He's a Principal Program Manager in the team and was directly responsible for many of the SMB continuously available and transparent failover features that you'll see that we'll talk about today, and he will also demo. So, welcome. Thanks for coming. If what you know about Windows Server Storage is one of those pictures up on the screen, you're going to find out that there's been some changes. Server 2012 for the file server is not an incremental release. It's a transformational release. We made fundamental changes in what we were going to accomplish. In fact, fundamental changes in the scenarios that you could cover. With Windows file server and storage in all previous versions, Windows file server was essentially a place to store documents that were created by Windows clients. That was fundamentally the objective. With Server 2012, we went after a different objective. We said, we're going to go create storage that will reduce the cost of deploying Windows servers and enable deploying Microsoft's Windows servers against a file server and make your life easier for running a data center. Does it matter? Well, we're going to talk about a bunch of features. I found that it's not particularly interesting to talk about features if we don't tell you something about why it matters and why we did it in the first place. So we're going to talk for a few minutes at the beginning about what we set out to accomplish and why we think it matters. And we'll find out if you guys agree with this. So we start with, does storage matter at all? But for the planning for this version of the server, we talked to a lot of customers. We read a lot of reports from analysts. And what we found out was that there was a very large and increasing share of customers' IT budgets that were going to the storage component of their IT budget for servers. About, in fact, 40 to 50% of the total IT budget for their server infrastructure was going to storage. There's some reasons for that. There's some historical reasons for that. But what we set out to do was take that very large pile of money that people spend on storage and give them a broader range of choices. There'll still be lots of support. We'll talk about the range of options later. There's lots of support for high-end storage solutions. But we wanted to extend the range of things that you could do with Windows Server. This is the feedback that we got from people. We did thousands of customer interviews, tens of thousands of data points that we collected, rolled them all up. But here's what they were saying. Give me less expensive storage solutions, options that I can deploy with less cost for the hardware, less cost for the expertise, less cost for the underlying infrastructure and fabric management. Give me file-based solutions. There are file-based solutions in the market for other operating systems and other competing server solutions. And customers are telling us those are easier to deploy. They're more flexible. Give me file-based options. But, oh, by the way, don't lose my data and don't make my servers go down. So we had to think about how do we deliver what they asked for, file server-based solutions, at the reliability and availability that people had come to expect from the storage solutions they already had. So in Server 2012, this was our objective: build enterprise storage on industry standard hardware. And the way we went about it was started with a design target of there's some storage solutions out there in the form of storage array networks that have set the standard for what people have come to expect for enterprise storage. So we wanted to match the value proposition of the key attributes of the storage that was available in SANS. Availability and reliability had to be equivalent. They needed to have competitive performance, better or worse, but it had to be within range. CPU overhead had to be similar because one of the characteristics of SANS storage was that it offloaded some of the CPU processing. And a critical piece of what we were looking for was to be able to run SQL Server and Hyper-V solutions against these storage backends. And if you can run it against a file server, but you dramatically increase the CPU overhead on the Hyper-V or SQL Server, that leaves less computing resources and reduces the efficiency and effectiveness of the server solution all up. So we had to address CPU overhead. And of course, you have to be able to do backups. So what we think we've delivered, substantially lower cost across acquisitions, the deployment, the maintenance, the operations, better serviceability and flexibility, and easier to deploy and manage. So let's talk about how we got there. Here's, if I can get the build to work, here's essentially what we've had in the past. We've had single discrete systems. You could build a server, put storage behind it. Usually that was direct attached storage. Or at the high end, we had clustered servers and typically some sort of external shared storage arrays. I left a big gap in the middle that we wanted to fill. The small businesses, in many cases, were pretty happy with the single discrete systems. Enterprises were, for the most part, largely forced down to the other end of that spectrum. But we wanted to fill in options in the middle. So what we have now is deployment options that give clustered capabilities, either discrete cluster, system clusters, or a new deployment option that we'll talk about later in the slide, what we're calling a cluster in the box with multiple systems and storage integrated into one box with the idea of being able to have people who don't have lots of a PhD in clustering be able to deploy and operate these things. So two nodes for smaller deployments and up to four nodes and grouping these sets of clustered devices together. There's a range of different kinds of ways that you deploy it. This is the only eye chart slide in the deck, I promise. But we went specifically after the end-to-end scenarios of what is it that we want to be able to deploy. The virtualization with Hyper-V, still supporting the IW information worker client-based solutions, as well as data center servers and applications like SQL Server. So, what are we going to talk about? In order to deliver the kind of highly performant, highly scalable, reliable storage that we just set out as a goal, we had to address several different things. So we're going to talk to you about what we did against each of these criteria: availability, reliability, performance and scalability, data backup, storage efficiency, and then the deployability of the solutions. So with that, we'll start with storage availability, and I'm going to turn it over to Klaus, who's going to talk about the availability solutions in Server 2012.
Thank you, Gene. So first, let's define what we mean by continuous availability. So this definition that we're using is software and hardware platforms are designed to support transparent failover without data loss. That, of course, means, what does transparent failover mean? Transparent failover means the ability to survive a planned move on unplanned failure without errors, without losing data, and while performing well at scale. So effectively, at the end of the day, we want to be able to allow storage solutions where we can perform maintenance and there can occur unplanned failures, where applications such as SQL Server or Hyper-V that is using that storage can continue to run despite failures in the storage layer. So one of the core features to do that is in a feature we call SMB Transparent Failover. Before we go there, let's take a look at how these things actually work today and are not transparent. So if you have a Windows Server 2008 R2 file server cluster, and you got an application that is connected to it, let's say you use SQL Server, and you want to perform maintenance on the node that is currently active, you will want to move the workload over to the node that is currently inactive so I can perform my maintenance. Now, unfortunately, in that scenario, the file handles that SQL Server has open will be lost, and SQL Server will need to perform recovery. That is not good because that leads to application disruption, and it leads to the administrator requiring to go in and reattach the database, start SQL recovery, etc. And worst of all, the business that we were doing using our SQL Server database is lost. So that works well for the traditional scenario where we have end user storing Word documents, etc., because effectively the user often will just retry saving the document. But for SQL Server and Hyper-V, that is not acceptable. So in Windows Server 2012, we introduced a feature called SMB Transparent Failover. So effectively, that is the ability for the file servers in a cluster configuration to fail over in such a way that we have zero downtime with just a small I.O. during the actual failover, small I.O. delay during the failover, so that is completely transparent to SQL Server. And it supports a variety of cases. Most common is if you want to do a planned move in preparation of maintenance. You want to load balance and move resources around in the cluster. I need to restart my OS for some reason. I have an unplanned failure, say a power failure in one of the file server nodes, or I lose a network card or something like that. And with the scale-out file server, which I'll talk more about tomorrow, we can also redirect the clients between nodes to load balance the incoming I.O. So SMB Transparent Failover works for both what we call file and directory operations. So what does that mean? Well, we have SQL running. SQL opens a number of files. So that's fairly obvious that the files need to be able to transparently fail over. But what does it mean to fail over a directory operation? Think of the scenario where I have a running system and I'm deploying a new VM into the system. At that time, Hyper-V will actually create a folder structure or a directory structure on the remote file server representing a virtual machine folder and some other folders. Those operations at the time of creation of those folders also need to be transparent so that we can perform deployment of virtual machines in the middle of, let's say, we do a failover. Because, as I said, it needs to be transparent. In order for this capability to work, we require the server to be in a Windows Server 2012 failover cluster, and the server that is running the application needs to be Windows Server 2012 as well. So in effect, SMB Transparent Failover will not work with what at this time would be down-level systems like Windows 7 clients or Windows Server 2008 servers. Now let's talk a little bit about, so how do we actually accomplish this? So there is a number of components that are involved in making sure that the actual move of file handles and SMB connections between two servers is completely transparent to the application. So in the SMB 3.0 client, we have the capability of replaying an operation. Say, for example, I had a read in play, a failover happened, I can replay the read operation. There are other operations that you cannot just simply replay, like say you delete a file. I call a delete file. Now, if there's a failover happening on the file server side, the client will not know if the file server actually completed the delete, but just didn't return the result to me before the move, or it didn't complete the delete at all. So if I just brain dead, just issue the delete operation again, well, then I would either get success back, or I would get the object is not found because the delete was successful prior to the failover. So that's why we need some state persistence of what is going on between these two systems. And that's where the SMB 3.0 server comes in. So it actually enables support for network state persistence of what is the state of the file handles and the connections for SMB. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. In addition, to make sure that we don't have data that is sitting in a file server in cache waiting to be written to disk, we always open the file handles on the local file server as write-through, so that we ensure that data is already always written to disk in the case a file server node becomes unavailable, say a hardware failure. It would be detrimental to this type of solutions if you had a number of orders that was written into memory but was not yet committed to disk, and your file server for some reason failed, and that would basically mean that you would lose those orders. That is not acceptable. A new component that is introduced in Windows Server 2012 is what we call Resume Key. Resume Key is effectively the manager of the state information that we're using during recovery after a failover for both planned and unplanned. So it holds all the state information so that when the client comes back after the failover has completed, we can reinflate the entire state information, including whether that file I was talking about before was actually deleted or not in storage. The final piece is what we call the witness service. So the witness service plays a critical role, especially in unplanned failure cases. Now, because SMB is a protocol that runs over TCP/IP, the way a client would actually find out that a server that is communicating to has failed would traditionally be by having TCP timeouts. It would observe that I try to send a package to the server, it timed out because it just went away. I try to send another one, it timed out because it went away. And at this point, I say, well, okay, probably that server is gone, so let me try and reconnect. The problem with that is that those two TCP timeouts will take approximately 40 seconds in most cases. And that's a very long time to be without I.O. to your storage. And that's where the witness service comes in. So the witness service enables us to basically speed up the notification of that a file server actually failed so that we can tell the client, that file server you're using failed, fail over now and reconnect to another server. Now, if this all works completely transparently if you're using SQL Server and Hyper-V, et cetera, if you have applications that you've written on your own, you can use this as well. If you have a line of business application and it can store data files on remote SMB shares, if that application is running in a cluster configuration, then you will want to pay attention to this. This is basically a new API that application can use to register for the ability to store my data on a remote file server. So your application developer will need to become familiar with the register app instance API that is at the bottom of the slide. I'm not going to demo any code on this. I'm not going to go into more details on it because I think most of you are probably IT infrastructure and not developers. But you will want to let your developers know that there's something they need to pay attention to, and the links are in this deck so they can find more information about it. The other two APIs over here is effectively mechanisms for which you can call into a handle that has opened on a remote file share, and it'll tell you information back of whether that file handle has the continuous availability property set on it so that it will be transparent when it fails over. So that's effectively a check that the application can do, says, yes, that backend storage actually supports this capability so I can rely on it. Now, let's do a little demo. So what I'm showing here is a system. What you have here is basically a SQL Server. So this is the SQL Server administrative, SQL Server manager. And I just ran a disk report that shows some of my data file space usage and my transaction log space usage. And if we scroll down here, you can see that the physical file name that where these SQL databases are stored are actually on a remote SMB share. You can see that by the UNC convention here that says WAC V6000-SMB-A, et cetera. So this is a single SQL server that is attached to a remote file server that has two nodes in it. If we go open Failover Cluster Manager, we're taking a look remotely into that cluster. So we can see that we've configured two file servers in that cluster. Because we have two nodes, we want to make sure that we take advantage of both of them. So in this particular instance, this is a we're using a cluster-in-a-box solution that Gene will talk more about later that basically is two computer nodes with some shared storage in one piece of sheet metal. In this case, it's a technology showcase using some hardware from Violin Memory. So what I'll do is I will use my load generator here. So it's going to start and perform some SQL transactions. And the way we can see that is if we go take a look here, this particular performance monitor counter is looking at the number of SQL transactions that are being performed per second. And we can see here that the load generator is now warming up, so we're currently performing 4,500 transactions per second. If we go take a look at a different set of performance counters, so this is effectively from the SQL server, I am looking at the remote shares that I'm connected to and the performance that they provide to me. So through these counters, I can see information such as what's the average second per read or write. So I can see that the latency I have to my storage here is 1 millisecond. I can also see down here, which is data requests per second, I have around 200,000, well, now it's 208,000 was the high point right here, of IOPS. So that 200,000 IOs per second that is actually being performed against the remote storage. Back to the cluster manager here. So this is all well and good. It runs like you would expect it to, very fast. And then I need to perform maintenance on one of the nodes. Let's say, for example, it is that time of month where I need to perform a software update of one of the nodes. So what I want to do is I want to take this particular file server and move it to the other cluster node. And this is where, where you can see that that small I/O delay is occurring here for those 4 or 5 seconds, and then the I/O is picking back up. So SQL didn't stop. It just saw an I/O stall for a number of seconds and then picked back right up. Now, you will, of course, ask some questions. So why is it a little slower than it used to be? Well, that's because right now I only have one file server on the back end supporting all the I/O that the SQL server is doing to it instead of two. So once I'm done with my maintenance, I can then move this back, and you'll see that once more, we have a small I/O stall, and then as it picks back right back up, you will see that we actually get back to the performance we enjoyed before we started the maintenance period. So that effectively showed you SMB transparent failover in action using a SQL Server running with 200,000 IOPS towards the file backend storage.
Pretty sweet. Feel free to applaud.
Let me just stop it here.
So the SQL Server keeps running and your business keeps running.
It's as good as it gets. Now, another piece that is very critical is, so we have large file systems, and with large file systems comes large files, typically, and a high number of files. So another key improvement for availability is that when you hit a file system corruptions, which could happen, then in the past, these check disk operations could take a long time. Hours, sometimes, maybe even days. So what we have done is we basically, the check disk process consists of a scanning process and a repair process. And what we did was we took the scanning process, which is the majority of the time spent in check disk, and made that online. Right? So that can happen while the system is online, and then only the repair process needs to happen when the volume is offline, which makes your data available much longer. And so as you can see from the graph on the right side, we tested it with 100 million, 200 million, and 300 million files within one file system, one volume. And here you have the comparison between server 2008 R2 in minutes and server 2012. And those yellow bars are actually higher than they should be, but they need to be visible on the graph. We're talking seconds in fixed time.
So 300 million files, it used to be 375 minutes. How about 8 seconds, folks?
Now, even better, if that file system is sitting behind a CSV volume in a cluster, then this offline period is completely transparent to the application as well. So SQL will see, just like you saw with the transparent failover, exactly the same what you would see if I had to run the NTFS checklist behind it. We'll just stall the I/O for a few seconds, fix it all up, and come back. But in this case, it's completely transparent. And then finally, we will support, in practical deployments, volumes up to 64 terabyte in size. Now, the demo I just did showed me manually moving the resource group over to another cluster node to perform patching. Now, in Windows Server 2012, we're introducing what we call clusterware updating. Now, clusterware updating is a mechanism that does orchestration of maintenance of the cluster. Right? So basically, when you approve the updates to go in, let's say it's a software update, you approve the update, then the clusterware updating determines that there is an update that is needed and is applicable to this cluster. It moves the workloads off the node for the update. It pushes all the updates to that cluster node. It restarts the nodes if necessary. And once it's done, it moves the workload back. And then it moves on to the next node. So effectively, it cycles through the entire cluster. And at the end of it, you have them all patched. And you have every workload back to the original node where they used to be, assuming you have no other actions in the cluster at the time. So, storage reliability.
Can you take that?
Yeah, sure.
So we talked about availability. A lot of changes. That's not enough. The data has to actually be reliable as well, because in addition to losing a server, you might lose a disk. And when you talk about the kinds of systems that sit behind in enterprise data centers as storage behind server applications, it's sometimes in the hundreds of disks. And when you have that much hardware, something's going to fail. In addition, we really wanted to be able to operate these systems with industry standard components, which meant we wanted to be able to use SAS disks in JBOD configurations, just a bunch of disks rather than external storage arrays or enclosures. So we did a bunch of work around resiliency. We'll talk about a couple of them. There's a new virtualization layer in Windows that you've probably heard about if you've been to any of the storage presentations so far, called Storage Spaces. So Storage Spaces virtualizes disks into pools, allows you to create virtual disks out of those pools, but it also supports both mirrored and parity spaces, which are equivalent to the kind of disk error protection that you get with hardware RAID, only it's done with software, and it's done in a way that doesn't require uniform disk sets so that if you have a failure, we'll immediately start rebuilding the data on all the available disks that are out there in 4 megabyte chunks so that we can get your system restored and up and running just with standard disks. So the redundancy is built into the operating system if you use storage spaces. If you are the kind of company that wants to use hardware RAID, we support that too, and we've been working with hardware partners so that you can now use in-host hardware RAID with clusters, where the adapter is cluster aware and is coherent in the caching across members of the cluster, so that if you have a write in flight, you lose the server, the transactions are picked up by the other adapter in the cluster, so you don't lose anything. If you want to see these, LSI has them downstairs. You can take a look at what they've got. And then one more thing about resiliency. The operating system, file system itself, has been around for a while. NTFS was built, say, 20 years ago. So we have a completely new file system that's being introduced called the Resilient File System, or REFS. And that has the ability to further reduce the places where you'll have the need for repairing problems in the file system. It eliminates check disk entirely because it's allocate on write, so we never overwrite data, and you never have a partial write that has corrupted your system. So for applications and deployments that where REFS is appropriate, take a look at this. This is going to become the new standard file system for Windows over the course of the next releases. All right. Availability, reliability. Now we're going to talk about some performance and scalability, because if you can do all of that, but you can't scale it and it can't operate at the performance levels expected, that's not enough. So Klaus, tell us about scale and perf.
Thank you, Gene. So the first objective was effectively, well, so everybody that runs SQL Server, for example, or Hyper-V today, is using direct attached storage, either by disks that are actually inside the chassis of the Hyper-V or SQL Server, or through an iSCSI or a fiber channel SAN. So the objective was to basically be at least on par with those types of deployments. So we did a top-to-bottom performance analysis of tuning. We used SQL Server as the first proxy for this. We ran SQL in an online transactional processing scenario against a local storage. And then we basically took the exact same storage and put a network cable in between that and the SQL Server. So we basically have from SQL Server over a 1 gig network to a file server, and then have the same storage on the back end, where the data is placed exactly the same place on the platters, et cetera. So this is a true one-to-one comparison. So as you can see here on the graph on the right, the blue line to the right is showing what we had for DAS, as in direct attached storage. And when we started the project, which is SMV2, which was before we started down on the Windows Server 2012 path, you can see that running SQL Server over SMB was about a quarter of local storage. That was unacceptable to us. So we did optimizations on both the server side as well as substantial work in the SMB client side. And that led us to, in SMB3, being able to do what you see in the purple bar there, which is 98% of what we could do with local storage. So basically, I took a 1 gigabit network cable and put it in between the SQL Server and the backend storage, and I could achieve 98% of what I did locally. So that enables me to take advantage of all the flexibility that you get with file-based remote storage, that I can leave my storage around and I can move my SQL Server anywhere I want in the data center and just attach to that storage. I can move my SQL engine to a more performing box without actually moving the storage with it, because the storage sits elsewhere in the data center. I don't need to mask and unmask LUNs because it's just a file share, and as long as I have the user credentials, I can get to it. Now, another part was that 1 gigabit pipe that I was talking about. How about we make it so that we can use if we have multiple of them? So that's where the SMB multi-channel feature comes into play. So let's say I have multiple 1 gigabit network adapters between my SQL server and my backend file server, or between my Hyper-V server and my backend file servers. How about we actually just aggregate the bandwidth that those makes available to us? And that's exactly what SMB multi-channel does. And in addition to that, we said, okay, so if I'm using, let's say, 4 of these, what if one of them fails? Well, then we just back off and continue to use the other 3 without missing a heartbeat. So the resiliency that I just demoed to you on the file server side, as in server fault tolerance, we also have similar fault tolerance on the network part, where we can basically tolerate the loss of one or more links as long as there is at least one link left.
And what does it take to enable multi-channel on my new server?
It just takes putting more network adapters in your network and put some IPs on it. SMB multi-channel will automatically discover the availability of those network adapters. It will go query the server side and say, what do you know? And then it'll do a comparison, and it'll use what it can use.
How much easier can it get?
Yes. So here we show a configuration with 1 gigabit Ethernet. We, of course, also support 10 gigabit Ethernet. And even further, when you have used SQL Server and Hyper-V, what is the most and most precious thing that they need? It's CPU and memory. Right? So when you run storage over IP networks, you're suddenly activating the IP network stack, which causes CPU costs, right? We're spending CPU cycle creating these TCP packets, creating these UDP packets, sending them over the wire, etc. So what we also did was we introduced a feature called SMB Direct. So SMB Direct effectively enables us to utilize network adapters that have RDMA on them. So RDMA is an acronym for Remote Direct Memory Access, which effectively is a mechanism for which you can move data between the two computers without involving the TCP/IP stack. So what does that give us? Well, it gives us minimal CPU utilization for I/O processing. So at the Storage Developer Conference last fall, we showed two systems communicating back-to-back using an RDMA-enabled network adapter, where we were pushing 2.5 gigabytes per second with 4% CPU utilization. 4% CPU utilization. And I said 2.5 gigabytes. That's like 2 seconds for a DVD. And I know that there are other sessions this week that are talking about even higher numbers, such as 10 gigabytes, et cetera. And they're all leveraging the SMB Direct path, because that basically makes us be able to give all the CPU back to the application that really needs it. Right? We don't earn more money by sending data over the wire. We earn money by SQL doing transactions or Hyper-V doing its work.
So RDMA was a HPC, high-performance computing technology. In 2012, our goal is to make that mainstream so that it runs in the data center and every server is going to want to use it. You can go downstairs. Several of the network vendors are implementing and building RDMA network adapters that will be available and have drivers available for Server 2012.
And similar to SMB multi-channel, we automatically discover the capability of the network adapters to support RDMA and start using it.
Put it in and it works.
And further, SMB multi-channel and SMB Direct works together, so that if I have multiple network adapters that supports RDMA, then we can aggregate across these multiple RDMA-enabled network adapters, and now we can start go really, really fast. Now, the last piece I want to talk about in terms of scale-up performance is the scale-out file server for app storage. So when you deploy a file server in a cluster configuration, you actually get to have a choice now between what we could call the classic file server mode, which is what I just showed you, and then a new one is called the scale-out file server, which effectively is an active-active. So what do I mean by active-active? So in the classic model, a file share is In a classic mode, one file share is online on one node and one node only. That means that the bandwidth I have to the data on that share is limited by that particular node. If I have that file share enabled on all my cluster nodes, that means I effectively have the aggregate bandwidth across the cluster available to that share. So assuming everything is being equal, that provides you a lot more bandwidth into and out from the cluster. In addition, the way it's implemented actually has a side effect that management becomes a lot simpler. So in the past, you had to have multiple computers, and if you want to use them all, you had to create multiple resource groups with multiple names, with multiple IP addresses, et cetera, and move these buckets of load around a cluster. With scale-out, you just create one name, you turn your cluster disk into CSV volumes so they can be accessible on all the nodes, and then you start creating shares. We don't use virtual IP addresses. We don't use traditional cluster disk that needs to move back and forth. It means that everything is plumbed and online on all the nodes, which actually also means that failover is even faster than what you just saw. So, backup. So all this is well and good. We also want to be able to backup. So if you're familiar with Volume Shadow Copy Services today, VSS, VSS is a system that works in one computer and one computer only. Right? So I run my backup application. It connects to an agent that is running on, let's say, my SQL server. And then everything else runs inside that computer. The VSS feature today does not allow you to actually create a snapshot that is on remote storage like over an SMB file share. So that's why we introduced VSS for SMB file shares. It basically enables you to do an application consistent shadow copy for a server application that stores its file on the remote file share. So for example, I have 50 VMs. I want to do a snapshot of 10 of them. Then what happens is the backup server talks to the backup agent on the Hyper-V server. The Hyper-V VSS writer reaches into all the VMs and makes sure that all the application state is app consistent. Once that is done, it asks the underlying VSS engine to do the snapshot. And in the case of VSS for SMB file shares, we effectively relay that snapshot request over to the file server side, where we actually perform the snapshot over on the file server itself. And once that is complete, we then return the snapshot path back to the application server, and then it could do whatever it needs to do to finalize the snapshot and then hand that path back to the backup server. At that point, the backup server can choose to either get the data directly from that share we created where the backup data is, or it can go back to the application server and read it from there. Now, this feature does require that the backup ISVs enhance support and support this scenario. So if you are deploying this scenario and you want to do backup using a host-based backup of Hyper-V, then you will want to make sure that you check with your backup ISV that they support this scenario. So storage efficiency. So what did we do there, Gene?
Well, now that you have a file server that's highly available, the data is reliable, we have failover for the servers, failover for the network connections, it's as performant as local attached storage, and it scales out. Well, one more thing that we thought that you folks wanted. In fact, that's what customers told us. They wanted efficiency in the storage. They wanted deduplication, and many customers were spending lots of money on external deduplication solutions. So I'm happy to tell you, deduplication is in the box in Windows. It's also easy to use. You turn it on, it's by volume. There's some technical reasons, and if you didn't go to the file server management session this morning with Matt Dixon and Fabian Unze, take a look at their session. It walks into the details of deduplication a little more than I have time to do here. But essentially, it's built around a volume. You turn it on. Its volume is self-contained, so that if you move that to another server or copy that around, all of the deduplication information is there. You turn it on, there's some dials that let you exclude certain folder locations or exclude certain file types and set how many days aging you want from zero to whatever you want. By default, we deduplicate files that are over 5 days old, haven't been written to it in 5 days. It gets efficiency that depends on the type of data you store, of course. If you have data with lots of redundancy in it, like VHD libraries, we'll get very high deduplication effects, sometimes as much as 80 to 90%. For a typical file server, we're seeing around 45, 50%. And again, it depends on whether the files are already highly compressed, because the deduplication both identifies the redundant data, and then it takes the chunks that have been deduplicated and compresses them further in storing them. So for primary workloads, it's designed for primary workloads. It runs in the background. So if you need the performance for the file server itself, it backs off. It can run, you can schedule it to run at particular times, but the data is deduplicated in the background and reconstituted on the fly as you access it. By the way, it's also integrated with branch cache. So for those of you that have a branch cache enabled for remote office access across WANs, the chunking and hashing that we do for deduplication is exactly the same as used for branch cache. So if you've turned on deduplication on your file server, all of that is pre-computed, so the first access will get you chunked and compressed files across branch cache. All right, storage deployability. Available, performant, scalable, reliable storage, efficient, but I have to deploy this thing. So we have something for you there too. One of the things that we thought that we wanted to do as a present for you folks, as we delivered this kind of file server that really depends much more on clustering to deliver the full benefits of availability that we've built into SMB3, is let's make clustering easier. As I said at the beginning, clustering has tended to take a lot of expertise, and it took a lot of steps, a lot of time, and it was error-prone to set up. There have been improvements in that incrementally over time, but we decided to take a quantum leap here. So we worked with hardware vendors, some of them who are in partner booth downstairs, to build reference designs for these things that we're calling cluster in a box. So if you think about what it takes to deploy a cluster now, you buy a couple of servers at minimum. You have some shared storage that today has to be external, so you have at least three boxes. Then you have to get all the wires connected right to the right network interfaces, plug it all in, get it all configured, go to each of the servers, set them up with the clustering configuration, try to get them set up the same so that they work together. We measured this. It was like a 30-page instruction book and took somebody 3 hours if they didn't make any mistakes. So this is something that we expect people to be able to set up in 15 minutes, wheel it in, plug it in, turn it on. All the wiring is done. All the configuration happens off of a wizard. 15 minutes, you're up and running in a cluster. So we expect this to make a big difference for those of you who have branch offices and you have people in those branch offices that are not IT administrators. They're actually doing the work that whatever your branch office does. This enables deploying in those kinds of situations. It enables us moving into much smaller businesses. And By the time we get these things out into the market, we expect the price to be attractive enough so that these will become the building blocks for your data center. One more deployment is file servers have been, over the last 5 to 10 years, the trend has gone toward unified storage, file servers being unified with both file and block, serving at both SMB SIFS and NFS. So I just wanted to throw this slide in there to let you know that we have all of those in Windows, in the box now. So you'll have SMB, the Windows file serving protocol, but also NFS server and NFS v3 server with continuous availability that does the same kind of failover that Klaus just talked about with SMB. We'll also have a brand new NFS 4.1 server that it's fast, folks. And then we have iSCSI Target. The iSCSI Target has been available in Windows Storage Server, but it wasn't in Windows Server. We made it available recently, so if you have Windows Server 2008 R2 boxes that you need to run iSCSI Target on, that's a free download, but it's now in the box in Windows Server 2012 with continuous availability as well at significantly better scale. So we've come to the end. We'll have a little bit of time for questions. What's it all mean? Well, this is what we hope it means for you. It means that Windows Server 2012 can deliver this enterprise class storage availability, reliability, and performance that you've come to expect from the solutions that are out there in the market, but at a fraction of the cost, both for hardware and for the operation and maintenance. And the bottom line is this will enable you to have different options and is going to change the way that you can deploy server solutions for Hyper-V, for SQL Server, and for file server applications. So with that, I want to point to a number of other related sessions. There's product demo stations downstairs from too many vendors and partners to list here. And I will click through here because I want to get to there's resources to find more information. I want to get to the session evaluation tag so you can submit evaluations. But also, we're open to questions. Please use one of the mics so that other people can hear you. Thank you very much. Any questions? If you're shy, we'll hang around up front. You can ask individual questions if you don't want to use the mic. Thanks for coming.